Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is scheduled to be H. Lee Barnes, an award-winning writer. His novel, Cold Deck, is what we're going to be talking about. Unfortunately, Lee hasn't shown up yet. So for the next several minutes, Munchkin and I are going to be in scramble mode. We'll see how we do. There hasn't been a lot of gaming news recently. Here in Las Vegas, the juiciest story is Steve Wynn and his ex-wife, Elaine Wynn, are publicly fighting as to whether she will be on the board of directors of Wynn Resorts. Both Wynns, generally speaking, are well-respected here in Vegas, and now everybody gets to be a voyeur as some of the dirty laundry is being aired in the media. What fun! Richard, do you think she'll be allowed on the board of directors, possibly to get her to shut up? What do you think?
Boy, I really don't know. Divorces are messy things, and add $1 billion or something to the mix, and it really gets messy. So, she claims that she deserves a lot of credit for the Wynn success, and I mean, who knows? I mean, he was the public face, but who really knows how much she contributed? It's a soap opera. It'll be interesting to watch it play out.
There is a different subject. I've read a press release, and the details are sort of foggy so far. But IGT has had several wide area progressives, like Megabucks or Wheel of Fortune or some of the others, where several different casinos have these machines, and everybody contributes to this great big pot, and the pot gets pretty big. And so they said they're going to come out with a new one dealing with video poker. And it's supposed to be unveiled this weekend at the Golden Nugget in downtown Las Vegas. And it'll be based on Super Times Pay, which is a game where you get multipliers periodically. And so it's... Now, most wide area progressives are like 85% games plus the progressive. And it's hard to imagine video poker players playing that. So
That bad, 85 plus the progressive?
No. Yeah, they start at 85 at reset. And when the progressive rises, it can get all the way up to 89 or something. Still horrendous.
Oh, I see.
Wide area progressives are pretty bad. But presumably it's going to be something like a royal flush with a multiplier of 10, or maybe a dealt royal flush with a multiplier of something. I don't know what the trigger for the alarm is. It has to be more common than every 50 million hands, and there's a number of possibilities, but how it's going to turn out, I don't know. We'll definitely keep you posted. I can't see me playing it, but I would like to become more informed about what this video poker thing is all about. I have some good news, Richard. Mr. H. Lee Barnes is in the studio.
Oh, well, that's good to know.
Yes. And so let's introduce him. H. Lee Barnes teaches English and creative writing at the College of Southern Nevada. Prior to joining the education field, he worked as a deputy sheriff, a narcotics agent, a private investigator for the Griffin Agency, construction labor, casino employee. He served in Vietnam as a member of the Special Forces, Green Berets. He's a hiker, motorcycle enthusiast who regularly tours the highways of the Southwest and occasionally rambles down the inviting back road. That's a nice sentence. H. Lee Barnes, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you, and my apologies for being tardy. I actually talked to somebody outside and said they used to have a bunch of radio studios there, but they moved, so I had to go back and read the directions again.
Oh, dear. Well, all's well that ends well. We only had to fake it for a few minutes, and we're going to be fine.
We're still faking it, right?
Oh, I hope not. I hope not. We're gonna give you a chance to fake it for 5 minutes.
Okay.
About your book, Cold Deck. Why don't we start with you giving a 5-minute synopsis of the book, and then Richard and I will ask you some questions about it.
Okay. Remember, folks, that this is fiction. It centers on a character named Jude, and the story begins, or the novel begins, if you will, the day that the MGM is burning down, and Jude is a dealer. He has his own notions about what he wants to do with his future, which include something like building cinder block walls and having his own little small construction firm and getting out of the casino business, which has been fairly good to him in terms of money, but is otherwise very dissatisfying. And then the fire occurs, and Jude struggles his way out. And in the process of struggling his way out, he kind of comes out a bit damaged from it, because when he looks up, he sees people actually jumping from the hotel. And then he sits down, and he's not really fully cognizant of what's going on, and wanders across the street to the Maxim. And there, a kindly security guard kind of takes control of him, seeing that he's got the uniform of a dealer at the MGM, and helps him out a little bit. And then he calls his wife, and she's too busy to talk to him. She's tired, and she kind of dismisses him, and he's stuck with what he's just experienced himself. The story then, we entered into it several years later, more than a decade later, and Jude is still employed in the casino business, but this time at another casino, and he shows up at work late, and as a result, he's fired. The hint is that there's something more to his firing than that, because the man who fires him was a break-in dealer when he was a break-in dealer downtown at the Mint. It proceeds from there to him getting a job through a friend who sends him out to a small casino, and it works out there for a while, and then Jude gets arrested, and the police come for a minor event, and the police.
We'll talk about that minor event. It's interesting.
Okay, good. and as he returns to go back to work, the boss says, "I have to fire you. You were arrested while you were at work, and it's not quite the same." So in the interim, his daughter is engaged in a group activity with some other girls. Jude and his wife are separated, divorced actually. And on his Father's Day with his daughter, he goes to a karaoke event. Thank you. And while there, he meets a woman named Audra, who goes by the name of Adi. I named her after a bartender that I thought was quite attractive, by the way. And she helps him find a job. And it's an interesting set of circumstances, because the job she helps him find is a really good job to land in. And he goes there, and oddly enough, later on, the same guy that fired him comes to that particular casino and goes to work there. But there's a reason behind that too. What Jude doesn't know is that while he was working at the first casino that he was fired from, which is actually the second casino he was fired from, but we'll get to that, he actually witnessed something that he wasn't aware that he witnessed. And he bears the burden of that as he goes over there and gets this job. Over a period of time, this woman begins to take control of him in certain ways. He thinks that he's in love with her, or whatever you would call love. between two people who are so disparate and have different interests in mind. And she introduces him to this kind of nefarious character who is kind of shadowy at the same time. And they set Jude up so that he engages in a minor cheating scam, if you will, considered by virtue of what the profits are. Unbeknownst to him, as he's performing this simple trick, which is called a card switch, and we'll get into that, he's being filmed by the very woman who induced him into getting involved with these people. And they use that to blackmail him to engage in a larger scam, ripping off a larger casino, this casino that he's gone to work for, an inside job. And I'll leave it there. Is that too? That's not enough time. I don't want to tell.
No, that's
whole
fine.
I think that's interesting.
I think you didn't really do the book justice. I mean, I thought the book was really entertaining. Although, you know, you were preaching to the choir. It's the kind of book that I really, really like. One of the things I wanted to say, one of the things that I really liked about this book is I felt like you really, really captured what it's like to be a dealer in Las Vegas. And it was clear that you, as the writer, I mean, it's... it's very clear that you live in Las Vegas and that you know a lot about the casino business and that you had to have been a dealer yourself. Because again, I thought you just captured it perfectly. What it's like, the drudgery of going to those casinos and how burned out the dealers get. And, the difference between, you know, a puppy and a Las Vegas dealer is that eventually puppies learn to stop whining. I thought the book was really good and that you captured those things really well.
It's very difficult in a synopsis to really give a sense of what the book's about, but I certainly tried to capture the atmosphere of the casino and the circumstances of the dealers, the tediousness of the work, the nature of standing on your feet for off and on for 8 hours with short breaks in between, and then coming to tables where people blame you as a dealer for what their losses are, and many who win don't even appreciate that when it happens. There's a sensibility that goes that I wanted to capture in this book, and that is that most dealers that I worked with and everything else either realized it was a dead-end job and accepted that, or thought it was a dead-end job and complained about it without trying to do anything to alter their circumstances. The other side of it is dealers, you know, it would be hard to categorize them as stupid. Most dealers are actually above average in intelligence. And one of the reasons they gravitate to that job is of course, that it's relatively good money, and you don't have to have a high education. A baccarat dealer at Caesar's Palace probably makes a hell of a lot more money than I do as a professor at a college. But what other than the money, what's the satisfaction of the job? And I think that's the biggest problem with being a dealer, and I try to set that as part of the book, is walking away at the end of the day and what satisfaction do you get out of it other than an income?
When were you a dealer and at which casinos?
I was a dealer back when the world was flat. So, no, I started the casino business in 1977. I think it was the very latter part of 1977. And I broke into a place called Little Caesars. And if anybody, if anybody remembers that, it was a nice day at the Little Caesars if you were a dealer, is if somebody didn't vomit on the table. I started off in craps there and then learned blackjack. And then I went from there to the Mint, which is no longer the Mint. It's part of the Horseshoe now. And there I learned roulette, and so I spent about 7 or 8 months there. I don't remember. And then I went to work for the Maxim, which is no longer, I don't think it's even a casino.
West? Well, it's kind of the West. Is it next door to the Westin, or is it the Westin?
I think it is the Westin, but I don't know. Do they have tables?
It's the Westin, yeah.
Do they have tables in there now?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. When it opened, the Maxim was really a kind of a really beautiful, you know, postmodern kind of rendition of a casino. They had all the glowing red rails in there where the stairs were and everything, and it was at the same time it was intimate. And it was kind of sad what happened to the Maxim over the years, but that's casinos.
It's interesting because, and we'll get to this later, that you were a Griffin agent, and the Griffin agency had an office there in the Maxim in the late 70s, early 80s.
I think it must have been in the early... I actually was never aware of that, but I've got story after story about the Maxim I've never told.
The other thing I thought you captured really well was anybody who lived in Las Vegas at that time, when that fire happened at the MGM.
That was about 1980?
Yeah, yeah. That was a major, major event. I mean, and really, really affected everyone. I mean, I remember the day it happened very clearly. I mean, I think it was one of those things for anyone who lived in Las Vegas, you remember where you were and... it was quite a horrible thing.
Well, it was also a turning point for the casino industry. Suddenly there was a new approach to what their responsibilities were towards, you know, both employees, but especially towards customers. Most of the people who were killed there, of course, were customers. And I actually witnessed... I was at JoJo's restaurant having breakfast, and I had a scheduled tennis match with somebody at the Sands, and I took Colville Lane. When I was in the JoJo's, the smoke was spilling out, and the waitress and I looked down there, and she thought, Jesus, you know, this is crazy. I said, oh, they'll get it under control, and I thought they would, and I thought the tennis match would go on. I drove down Colville Lane, and as I was approaching Mingo Road, I looked up and I actually witnessed, and that's why I put it in the book, I actually witnessed people jumping out of windows there. I think I saw at least two, if not three. The first one, I wasn't certain that I saw what I saw, so I looked again and then I saw them. And even though I'm a combat veteran from Vietnam and the rest and had been a cop for years, that really made my stomach sink. And it was an image that never left me, and I think that's part of what spurred me to write the book was that the desperation of people caught in a fire like that, the helplessness of them, and I knew I wanted to start when I wrote this, I said that's where I want to start that book so that people can a reader is there immediately and gets a sense of what tragedy that really was.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I have to say there was one there was one very sour note to me that just seemed so odd, such that I have to ask you about it. For someone who knew so much about dealing and all that, there were a few mentions in the book of a five deck shoe, and you know, 30, 40 years ago, they were dealing four deck shoes, and then it moved to six and eight, and almost nowhere ever. I mean, I don't think there's a place that I know of in Las Vegas that deals a five deck shoe. I'm just curious why you picked that number.
I dealt a five deck shoe.
Oh, that is very odd.
It's a really rare thing. At the Maxim, we dealt five decks out of a shoe when we dealt it.
No. Five decks out of a shoe of out of a six deck shoe is different than five decks.
Thank you.
So it was a six deck shoe, and you dealt five, and you just kind of transposed
you
it.
You cut the back out. Yeah.
You
cut okay. The back good. Out of the so back. A six deck shoe where you yeah. cut out five, or you cut out one deck.
But,
good.
But you're only counting if somebody's a counter, they're only counting out five decks and subtracting the other.
Yeah, on this show we know exactly what that means, but we just took the word five deck shoe differently. Good.
Yeah.
On the incident you mentioned earlier, where the guy gets fired from his job for getting arrested while at work, so you needed this in the novel, And so you had to pick a minor crime to get him arrested for. And you picked assault by dog shit. Now,
can that go over the air?
Well, my producer just made a big jump. So he tried to get it, and I suspect he will. But oh well. So it happened that somebody walked their dog every night and let the dog do a dump on the lawn, and then walked him home. And one night, our hero Jude captures it in a baggie or something like that and follows him home and basically says, you forgot this, and the guy didn't want it, so he dumped it on his shoe. So that's basically what the crime was. There are a lot of homeowners who would have a lot of sympathy for what Jude did. Of all the crimes you could have picked, how did you pick that one?
It's quite simple. When I lived over on Wenatchee Circle, a young dog and his older master would come over, and he'd invariably have him do his business on my yard. I didn't know who it was. And then one time I looked out, I got home early, and I looked out, and there the business was going on. I went and got a plastic bag and put it in a plastic, turned it upside down, put it in the plastic bag, followed the guy home, knocked on his door, and I said, and he came to the door, and I said, here, you forgot this. I didn't drop it on his shoes, but I just handed it to him. That's the kind of guy I am. I just want you to know what you're dealing with. I'm not normal.
Well, it's okay. Normal people don't normally come on this show, so that part is no problem. But you were also had been a Green Beret and a martial arts. You know, it was like messing with you would not be an intelligent thing to do for most people. Now, our character Jude wasn't anything like that.
No, but it was a moment for him. That's also what it was. It was an expression of his frustration with. If you take that as a metaphor, he's gotten fired for something that was not his fault at all. He was a little bit late. That wasn't the reason he was fired. He'd been fired from the Maxim, by the way, which I also went through for no reason. And it was the whole sense that this wasn't the dog just dumping on his yard. It was the world dumping on him. And it was his only recourse against that, or he saw it as his only recourse against it. So he waited until that moment occurred, and then he acted. And it was a turning point for him because he was willing to act when he had to. And it kind of foreshadows what later happens in the book.
Okay. There's a couple of scams in the book that are described. For those wannabe scam artists out there, this is not a how-to book.
No.
But one of the scams was set up by Jude's broken thumb. And so since Jude couldn't shuffle correctly, that made the deck trackable to players who knew how to do that. Now, my question now on this is to Richard. Richard, you used to track shuffles. Is having somebody having a broken thumb enough to make a deck trackable?
Well, actually, it could be. I mean, not quite as easily as it was portrayed in the book. But if you have a dealer who drops a big clump of cards, then, yeah, you could certainly memorize a sequence of cards that's not getting shuffled and be able to find good edges there. But not in the book, it's kind of a little bit too easy where they can, you know, just cut and immediately get dealt a blackjack off the top or whatever. It wouldn't be quite that easy, but certainly edges could be found from a dealer who is not shuffling the cards, you know, dropping clumps.
Yeah, we were, as dealers, we were very well aware of locators, as we called them, and I think that's probably and the idea of clumping. And actually, really alert pit bosses would, if they were paying attention, and very few were floormen, or floor person, whatever they call them now,
Pit critters is what we call them on this show.
Okay, that's good. That's good. If they're really alert and they're watching the dealer shuffle, they could probably detect dealers that aren't shuffling that way. But now that they have the shuffling machines in, I think, probably virtually all casinos, that's no longer the case because that you really get a random shuffle with those. But prior and that of course was part of the reason that they had to go downtown in the book is because they had to look for that's where the weakness is, and they had to place him in a place on a particular game in a casino where the clumping where he could do that. And I think if we think about a shoe, it's probably a little more difficult. But if it's a double deck, if you're dealing a double deck and somebody's clumping like that, you're going to have bunches. You're going to have them come in bunches of 8 and 9 and 10. And I think that any good locator, would be able to at least cut to every other shuffle or so, cut to winning hands somewhere along the way.
Yeah, usually when you cut, you would have to see the first couple of cards in the string come out to know exactly where you were. Mm-hmm. But then you would be able to construct, from there, knowing what the next cards coming were.
Yeah. And locating combined with counting can be a big advantage.
Well, you wouldn't be counting at the same time.
No, but that would be teams working that way.
That would be kind of overkill. You could have such a big advantage with the location, the sequences, that to add a little bit extra with counting probably was not worth the effort. But
all right, so now the main scam, which I don't really want to go into in great detail, but it involves a cold deck, which gives the title to the book. Now, what is a cold deck?
Well, it has different terms, cooler and cold deck, but it's a deck that's set up and running on the game. You have to have an insider to make it work. Somebody told me once that there were cross-rollers in the old days that could switch decks on a dealer. I don't know how the hell they managed to do that. I mean, but magicians do all sorts of weird things too, that deceive us. So, but a cold deck sets it up so that all the sequences in there are predetermined, and to disguise it, usually when they put in a cold deck, that not every hand is a winning hand, but they know when the winning hands are coming out because of the sequences, and it's just a matter of memorizing it. And usually they load the table up with as many players as they can, and preferably with at least one player who has a reputation in the casino as a high roller or a big player so that can justify the win.
Very good.
Coincidentally,
yes.
I knew a guy who got arrested for putting in a cold deck at the Sahara. His girlfriend was the dealer, and this was in about 1980, 81, something like that. Okay. And coincidentally, he was a floor man at the Mint.
I'm shocked.
Yeah.
So next time we're out of town, Richard, ask me about my cold deck story. We have too many questions to ask Lee tonight to take up the time on my stories. But next time somebody's late, ask me about that, and we'll go with that.
I will.
You worked for the Griffin Agency 30, 40 some years ago, long time ago.
Back when the world was flat.
Back when the world was flat. Yeah, my grandmother told me about those days. Yeah. So at that time, it was, in the 90s and stuff, in the early 2000s, members of our show generally considered Griffin agents the enemy, as they would identify advantage players. Now, what was it like working for the Griffin Agency in the 70s?
Well, in the 70s, that was the emergence, really, of counting. That's when people became aware of accounting. I mean, there were still pit bosses and casino managers who denied that counting actually had any effect. So Griffin was one of the first ones to circulate the pictures around. And that's how most of us worked, was off of the book of pictures who people who were suspected. Many of the counters were detected and photographed and then later identified, and he'd get mug shots somehow along the way. And then that was also the decline of the real old-time crossroaders, the ones who did card switches and you know, other gypsy moves on the table. They were still around, but many of them, in fact, even made the transition into counters. I don't think they were as skilled as like the Texas counter group that, that came up here and ripped off a lot of casinos before they ever got identified as counters. So we spent a lot of time just looking for people who were identified in the book, and then our job then was to point them out to casino bosses who would then make a decision on it. And sometimes if we – the other thing is that we were also aware of slot cheaters, and that was the time when cheating slot machines was rather easy, because Bally's had a tendency to – because they were completely mechanical, and we know mechanical things tend to break down, or parts of them do, and so the handles that were on the machines in those days would eventually wear out. So you didn't even have to string a machine, you know, and put a false coin in there or any of the rest of that stuff to beat it. And at that time, we spent a lot of our time focusing on slot players. We'd go through, and we got called out on big jackpots and identified, you know, we generally speaking, if we had a collector, that's somebody who, well, somebody else would set up the machine. If the collector showed up a few times or something, we would get suspicious on things like that. So by and large, we were more in an intelligence. We didn't make decisions about arresting or calling the cops in on stuff like that. It operated as just intelligence for the casino to help them police themselves. Now, I don't know what happened later on after I left, But I'm gonna give a shout out to Bob. Bob was a genius when it came to remembering faces and names. He was absolutely a genius. Bob was the kind of guy that if you got in the car with him and you were heading to the dunes, you might end up at Caesar's Palace because he forgot where he was going, but he never forgot a face. And working with him was interesting, and the experience was worth it. But it's one of those things where you're in and out of casino. I had to hit at least, I think we had 13 or 14 casinos under contract back then, and I had to hit all of them every night, and some of them at least twice. So it was a tedious job. It was 6 and 7 days a week. I went up to Bob one weekend, and I said, Bob, I need a vacation. I need a vacation. He says, okay, take an extra day off. That's when I was working 6 days a week. That was his idea of a vacation. And then he docked me pay. So. It got a little.
Sounds like a nice guy.
He was in his own way. He was a nice guy. I mean, because you know, he and Beverly would sit down and have a meal someplace, and they'd call me over in between calls and say, "Why don't you sit down here and have a bite with us or something?" So,
they would charge you though, wouldn't they?
No, he'd pick up the tab.
You know, people, the players today, it's so much worse in that regard because surveillance is so much better, and you know, the consultants can see things just over the internet and tap into the feed. But I mean, back then, the casino had to pick up the phone and call the Griffin agency, and they would send someone over. And you know, I remember in the early 80s, you know, we used to pay people to, you know, we knew where the Griffin agency would park when they came to each casino, and we would pay somebody, you know, 10 bucks an hour or whatever to sit outside and watch the parking space in case they showed up, and then come in and signal us that they had showed up, and you know, we'd head out the door on the other side.
My goodness, you are a shady character.
Well, you know.
I can tell Lee is shocked.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't be surprised. Bellman, when I worked vice for the old sheriff's department, Bellman would had signals where they would contact hookers inside the casino when we were working vice, so they'd scatter. It's very, very easy to drop a dollar or a few dollars on somebody and corrupt them in the casino business.
Yeah. But, you know, our biggest complaint about Griffin was that he lumped card counters, which is a completely legal activity, in with cheats. And, you know, he sort of created this impression that, you know, people who use their brain are the equivalent of people who are cheating the casino. So
yeah, that may be true in a sense, but the other idea is that the casinos don't want to lose money, and one of Griffin's missions, of course, is to save the casinos money because they're paying him money to save them money, And so counters. And that the other thing is that because he, his agency at that time, and specifically Bob, really, was able to identify all these people, it put him in a pretty good corner for telling, you know, actually informing the casinos. And now casinos have other ways of defending themselves against cheaters and certainly against counters as well. But I think I think Griffin's agency is still in operation. He's just not with it any longer.
No, yeah, Beverly is running it. Yeah. They went through a bankruptcy, you know, but they've come
partly
out of it.
Partly caused by a couple of our heroes on this show.
Yeah. They finally lost some lawsuits for some of that. But
there's one point in the book where Jude is a little bit late. And he's rushing to get to his place. And as he's coming up, a pass poster, a cheater at roulette, is running away from the roulette table. The pit boss is saying, "Stop that man, stop that man." And he comes close to Jude, and Jude just steps back and lets him go. Now, you were a Green Beret. You were a martial arts instructor. If that had happened to you when you were a dealer, presumably you could have stopped this guy rather easily. What do you think you would have done in that circumstance?
Well, it's kind of interesting because my attitude after I'd been a dealer in a casino many, many years was that I wasn't paid to do anything else but deal. I'll give you an instance. We had a fire at Harris. It wasn't a major one, but it was a kitchen fire and everything. And there was no plan to evacuate anyone. Security didn't even know what the hell they were doing. And I and another dealer who used to be a cop stepped out, and we started telling people, get out of the casino, do this. You know, that's the entrance. Just go out there and wait until the smoke settles, and the fire department gets here, and then you come back in. But please don't hang around here, because this was post the MGM fire. So the next day, the other, I can't remember his name, ex-cop, but he was a cop in New York, nice guy. We went up and we talked to the general manager. We said, you know, you don't have an evacuation plan. What you should do is you should post instructions for given casino employees in each area of the casino, dealers, slot employees, that if there is a fire, that this is what they're supposed to do to the customers, because they didn't do that at the MGM. And we ran the whole thing by him. And he said, well, thanks, but, and that never went anywhere. And that kind of sent a message to me that if you're paid to be a dealer, just be a dealer. And that's so when that happened with Jude, I wrote it that way. Now, what would I have done? I don't know under those circumstances. I probably would have brought him to the floor.
And gotten sued.
And gotten probably fired for doing it, you know. Casinos are very, very bizarre places to work for. The rules are the rules unless they're arbitrary, in which case they apply them anyhow.
Now, your novel, Cold Dick, ends in a satisfying place. However, there are a number of characters, and it would be kind of interesting to see what the next 2 or 3 years were like for those characters. Do you have any plans of making a sequel to Cold Deck, or maybe another novel in Vegas concerning Vegas that has nothing to do with Cold Deck?
As a matter of fact, I have a cop novel right now with both.
A police novel?
Set in Las Vegas, yeah, sure.
Uh-huh.
And it does involve, in some way, it involves, part of it is involves a an internal burglary again from a sports book. Remember the old Churchill Downs sports book?
Oh, sure. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, we know that that was mob-connected, right? I mean, we think it was anyhow. Maybe that's just a rumor. So that's part of the premise of it, is that there's a large sum of money taken from there. And I'm not going to go into detail, but that novel right now is with both an agent in New York and with a small publisher. I'm hoping that the agent in New York does something with it, because I don't think a small publisher really knows what he's got and or how to get it over the mountains. So I'll wait and see.
Th- The book business is a tough business these days.
Oh, it's brutal, brutal. Cut you. It's it, you can make more money cutting your organs out and selling them.
Yes.
Wow.
And it's very similar when you sit down and you, here's a year of your life or 2 years of your life to put a book together. It's like cutting an organ out.
Some of my organs might be more valuable than others. Now, about the mob, there was it was kind of implied in the main scenes happened around the year 2000, I think. And
actually late 90s, but yeah.
Okay. And it was kind of implied that the mob still existed. And certainly the mob was a big part of Vegas through at least the mid 80s. Was it your impression that the mob still existed in the late 90s and or still exists today? Or is that just fiction?
No, it's fiction. I mean, I'm not saying there's not residuals of the mob that might have had inroads somewhere in even some of the casinos, but not as they did. I mean, I think once Rosenthal got nearly blown up with that bomb, and Spilotra was killed, and they did the Aladdin, and all the sham front men were kind of exposed. I think it went away at that expense. But still, there were a lot of people, even in the 90s, who had gotten their jobs because they were given favors by the boys, as we used to call them. Mm-hmm. And they were still around. And I also wanted to give the impression that the Crossroaders evolved. That I mean, the central Crossroader in this case right here was a cheater who had become an eye in the sky man and had evolved into this. He understood technology. So I think that's what I was trying to create more than the sense of the mob. But Crossroaders did work for the mob in some cases.
Now, you're an English teacher. And an English teacher has to be in love with words. A key part of the novel deals with somebody mishearing the word largesse. Now, largesse means generosity. And he misheard it to mean something that meant big butt. Now, when Jude used the word, my immediate impression was that that was the author showing off his vocabulary and not something a dealer would use. How do you plead to this?
I was once a dealer, and I used that term.
Back then?
Well, also, yes. it's a joke, right?
It's
you
a
have
joke.
To use that
it's
word to
joke.
Pay off
sure.
the joke.
Sure, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the whole thing. I mean, when Jude says that, that's exactly what he's doing. It's a self-fulfilling joke for him as he says it. But he says it very clearly. Thank you for your largesse, you know. He's having fun with it. And,
he wasn't having fun. He was annoyed at this lady for she had been a relatively large winner and she flipped him a nickel, and he was ticked off at the small size of that. And so it was very sarcastic when he said,
"Well, sure, but you take your little moments of joy where you can get them." And
yeah, I mean, I actually thought that was spot on. I mean, yeah, I mean, it's exactly, I mean, yes, most dealers are not that articulate, but I mean, I thought it was exactly the kind of stuff you hear dealers say all the time, you know, certainly the attitude behind it, you know, and yeah, I mean, I don't know, I just thought it was perfect, you know, then he gets fired because the lady complained that, you know, he said she had a large ass. I mean, I thought it was perfect, actually.
Actually, there's another way that pun could have gone. I was playing video poker a few days ago right next to a Superman machine, and all the seats have a big large S on them, on the Superman's cape. So I don't think that's as funny, but...
No, I like it. I like it. That's,
all right.
That's clever.
If you put it in your next book, I want credit.
I probably will. I mean, one thing about writers, they're thieves too, not in the traditional sense.
You know. Well, both Richard and I are writers, and we also have. I think most writers are avid readers, and my experience is you have to be an avid reader to be a decent writer, and so we're always kind of borrowing things. Is that, as a writing teacher, do you agree with that?
I do. I'm not sure how much you really have to borrow, but you certainly have to read to learn how to manipulate language on the page and make it important, how to keep the narrative flowing forward or whatever you're trying to do. So I think reading is an absolute essential, and unfortunately many of my students don't take the same attitude about their view of it. I mean, what we're getting now is an awful lot of students who want to write fantasy and vampires and get rich overnight, and so
Game of Thrones.
So that's what influences television and things like that influence, as opposed to books. Whereas those people are usually serious about writing, are also serious about reading, and we gain a lot from that. I mean, I was a reader when I was in the casino. That was one way of blocking out, you know, the other problems that you have there, you know, bad days and stuff.
All right, we're talking to H. Lee Barnes, author of the book Cold Deck. Both Richard and I gives it thumbs up. I recommend you go pick it up. Most of our stories have something to do with improving your gambling skills, and today doesn't do that, probably, but it's a book that both Richard and I enjoyed and think you will too. Let's do some commercials. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anybody else has. Throughout March, there are two separate casino-wide progressives running 24/7 in the $600,000 March Money Madness. The bigger of the two progressives begins at $10,000 and must be hit before it reaches $25,000. One winner will get the big prize each time, and everybody actively playing with a player's card earns $25 in free play when the jackpot is hit. Immediately thereafter, it starts again at $10,000 and begins to climb. Simultaneously with this, there's a smaller progressive beginning at $1,000, which must be hit by $2,500. This, too, will start again immediately after it hits, and is predicted to be hit three times a day all month long. In the free video poker classes on Wednesdays at the Grandview Lounge, this next week will be Deuces Double Bonus. This is similar to Deuces Bonus, except it returns more for five aces, more for five threes through fives, and less for full houses and flushes. The game returns 99.82%, which makes it positive 24/7 when you include the 0.30% slot club and occasional double points and mailers, and it makes it a play where the player has the advantage. At the Palms, on the weekly 7 p.m. drawings on Fridays, winners share $10,000. You don't need to be there to win. You need to claim your prize by midnight or it evaporates. Five times entries, Friday 7:45 through midnight, and also two times entries on Friday between 4 and 6:30 in the afternoon. PFP, play for prizes, through tomorrow, Friday, March 27th. The prize is Chevron gas cards, up to $390 per day. The gift cards may be earned and redeemed through Friday at a rate of 0.20%. You keep your points. At videopoker.com, this is the best place to practice a lot of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, you get correction on most of the game. It's including some games where there is no readily available software anywhere which gives you that correction. One of such games is Quick Quads. For most players, you have no idea how badly you really play unless you get the correction. The game of the week is called Royal Hunt Poker. This is a triple play game with bonus rounds where you play 10 coins per line to activate the bonus. The triple play version of the game is played as usual with no strategic variations required. The bonus round plays itself. And the bonus round is positive. So that means if you know how to play the base game, then playing the Royal Hunt version is a better deal for you in terms of EV. The way the bonus round works is whenever you receive a 2-card royal flush, a 3-card royal flush, or a 4-card royal flush on the deal, you get 6 extra chances to play those royal cards, or actually the machine plays them for you. And if you end up with a royal on one of those, you get 4,000 coins. You end up with jacks or better, you get 20 coins. And there's various things in the pay schedule in between. To see how this works, let's assume we're dealt a full house, 3 tens and 2 kings, and that one of the kings was suited with one of the tens. So you're going to hold the full house in every game and collect in the triple play version. But the suited 10 king is going to appear on the 6 bonus games. So the first 3 play quickly, and you get paid if you score something from Jacks or better on up. If you draw another royal card, such say it's the king 10 of hearts, and you happen to draw the queen of hearts or the jack of hearts, that gets transferred over to the game on the right. So on the game on the right, you might be starting with a 3-card royal or a 4-card royal. And if you complete that, it's 4,000 coins. So you're going to end up getting lots more 4,000 coin royal flushes. To make this work, when you don't get those royal flushes, you're going to lose pretty fast on this game. So it does have a high variance, and but it is interesting, and that's the newest game from videopoker.com. Our guest next week is a part-time video poker player, and he has another job which pays him well. And he wanted to get the benefits of being a professional gambler tax-wise. So he dealt with he corresponded with the IRS, and they came up with a new category of part-time professional gambler. So if he meets certain criteria, which he did, he can take get those benefits from being a professional gambler, even though he has another job which pays more. This man's name is Bradley Davis. He wrote a book on Joker Poker back in about 1990. So he's been on our show before a couple of years ago. But in a week, he's going to be on talking about Joker Poker. All right. Lee, we got about 2 minutes left. You have another novel based on Las Vegas called Lucky.
Well, actually, I'd like to hear, okay. He has a book called Dummy Up and Deal that's about the casino industry, and I'd like to hear a little bit about what that's about.
Well, Dummy Up and Deal is a combination of stories that were told to me over the years, stories that were kind of part of the casino mythology, and my own experience in kind of disguised memoir form. That they're all short stories, and I think it really captures the essence of what it's like to be on the other side of the table in a casino. It's still available in both paperback and hardback and trade paperback.
All right, there's that book, and I've actually picked up the book called Lucky, which is a Vegas novel. It's a coming-of-age story for a boy who gets involved with a casino owner who seems a lot like Benny Binion, with a few differences, and I'm enjoying that. Is there any chance we can twist your arm at least once or twice to come back and talk to us about these other books?
I would be pleased to talk about either of them, yes. I enjoy talking about them after the fact. it's pretty better to talk about them than get those royalties that never come.
Yeah, both Richard and I have found we are not able to retire on the royalties from our books. So, good. So, Richard, where do people get our... Actually, never mind. We have 10 seconds left, so I want to thank H. Lee Barnes. I want to thank Richard. Good night, everybody. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel Casino and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.